to have the picture of the physical form of the saint before it is too late. And the photographs are marvelous indeed. His face during these last years of his earthly life was the exquisite expression of an almost divine loving kindness, which stands out even more dominantly than the wisdom and power which are so prominent in his former pictures. Some good photographers of the master are available. Perhaps the best known was taken some 16 years ago. It shows his face against the background of a kind of luminous cross formed by the reflection of light. Another one, well known to all readers of books on Maharshi, shows him in a classical yogic posture sitting cross-legged on a platform covered with a tiger skin. It was probably taken after his monthly shaving, for the features are free of the white beard, and both the purity of line and expression of incomparable power are emphasized more than in any other picture. Contemplating it, we see a certain gravity on the face of the saint, who has for so long left behind him all the weaknesses, imperfections, and miseries that reign among us. It shows one who has forever transcended all ignorance and now faces the highest reality where no doubts or fears can exist. Every month, after the shaving takes place, I have the inestimable privilege of contemplating the features of the living form itself with its clear-cut light. This marvelous head that is surrounded by a subtle fragrance of incense and the still more subtle aroma of the utter devotion and love of hundreds of hearts. Once one also perceives in this face that quality which is so rare in our brother men, infinite understanding. It is difficult to explain. But when one is in the presence of the saint, one has the certainty that the whole of our being lies open and bare before him, and that he sees into the very depths. Of course, all this might not be quite pleasant or comfortable for the majority of people were it to happen before eyes other than those of the Maharshi. But in his presence, no secrets can exist, nor does one have the slightest fear of criticism. What time is your flight?
It's actually 3 o'clock at Newark.
Oh, I see. So how are you going to get there?
I'm going to take a train. Yeah, it's. I guess I have to take a train at 12 o'clock. And it gets me there around 1 o'clock. And then I have
to... The train goes right to the airport, or you have to take a bus after
it? I have to take a shuttle after that.
Oh, it's a train shuttle?
It's a train, then a shuttle. Yeah.
He is like the highest tribunal of our conscience, the Father Confessor, whose very presence purifies us from all sin, as was said about 40 years ago by his friend, a Hindu saint, and clairvoyant, Seshadri Swami, the third well-known photograph represents the face of the master in a halo of white hair and beard with a soft smile of ineffable tenderness. Maharshi's mission on this earth is nearing its end. The oral teachings have been transmitted, transcribed, and published by disciples and faithful friends. A group of initiates remain to spread the words of wisdom to those who are able to hear and accept them. Now remains only the cross of final martyrdom, whose extent and purpose are unknown and inexplicable to us. It was not my privilege to see its stages on the physical plane. I was told that the magnitude of the Maharshi's physical suffering was terrible for those surrounding him. I believe that the all-wise providence knows best as to what are the limits of our strength and endurance in any period of life, The third picture of the sage, which I contemplated every day during the whole of my stay at the ashram, remained with me, forever engraved on my heart, not only in its outward appearance, but infinitely more. Just before the end, in April 1950, the master said to those around him, "They say I am dying, but I shall remain here more alive than ever. Verily, the spirit of Maharshi has remained with us. The photographs of Maharshi are now known all over the world. But how many people know the light which was brought by him from the realm of absolute bliss, the land of the highest spirit, and of the thorny paths, which are so narrow and difficult for most of us? Why are we so blind? Why are we unable to see this peace and bliss, wisdom and love, expressed so clearly even in the physical features of one who abides in that land forever? How much more resplendent must be that light there, where it is not veiled by the vehicles of matter, where shines the never-ending or never-setting sun, about whose luminous rays every being dreams in the innermost depths of his heart." You know, there's hundreds of pictures. You don't find one with Bhagavan's eyes closed.
Yes.
Chapter 17. One operation more. For a few days, rumors had been going round the ashram that another operation is soon to take place to cut out the malignant tumor, whose growth has become so terrifying, weakening the whole body of the sage. Last night, several surgeons came from Madras with bags full of instruments. They attended the evening meditation and exchanged a few words with the saint before leaving the temple hall. This morning, Maharshi was absent from his usual place, and the members of the ashram staff said that the operation was to take place about noon. All Westerners were on the alert, and many people were wandering around the temple. So why the Westerners were on the alert? I guess he only knew the Westerners. I don't know. The ones he knew. Going here and there in the vicinity of the dispensary where the operation was being performed. In the evening, we were told that the operation was over, but Maharshi was very weak and would not be able to leave the dispensary. Later, he sat in an armchair on the veranda of its white building, surrounded by surgeons and the ashram staff. And on the nearby square, a long queue had been formed by those who were anxious to see the master. One by one, they advanced, silently mounted the few steps, saluted, and immediately went down by the other side. I was not there. I went to the temple, sat in my usual place, and plunged into meditation. With no thoughts, no mental forms, and the quietness of that silence, which is more eloquent than words. You know, temple must have been very quiet back then, especially when nothing was going on.
Yes.
How marvelous is the peace of such a silence. It is beyond all the limits of time and human memory. It cannot be immediately interpreted in words because of certain reluctance on our part to touch this silence by thought. It does not allow us to use words until later. These pages, therefore, were written after some time had elapsed, generally during the free hours following lunch, when everyone goes to rest. And all the life of the ashram seems to be suspended and no one is in the temple hall. People generally sleep from noon to 3 p.m., but not myself. I have much correspondence. Letters reach me from all parts of the world in many languages, from people of different natures, temperaments, and levels of mental development. Already he's become famous, I mean. he's already got disciples. I thought this was his first. Must have had something going before that. In days of great peace, Moni Sadhu, this is a Westerner. I thought he only became known after this book. So he must have written some other papers or something. He discourages all physical movement, but the superphysical functions remain independent of it, and the mind works normally. When I finish my correspondence for the day, I take my diary or a few pages of my remembrances from India, which I am trying to write in a form suitable for the average layman. I do not quite like it and have taken it up without enthusiasm. Some will see in it an almost trivial type of description. Others will think it exaggerated and biased. All this cannot be helped. A few days after the operation, Maharshi appears in the temple hall, at first for a few hours only, then for a somewhat longer period, until finally the usual routine is restored for a time. Pupils and devotees, as well as admirers, come from all parts, probably to say farewell to the master and have his final darshan. Among them are Indians and Westerners of many nations. They are chiefly elderly people, coming for a short stay of perhaps a few days. Among them, there are serious as well as somewhat grotesque figures. One of the old disciples of Maharshi, the famous Yogi Ramaya, has remained almost 2 months in the ashram. Every morning and evening, he sat literally at the feet of the master, silent and dispassionate, wrapped in his white garments. He stayed quiet and motionless. After the operation, Maharshi is still thin, but a slight improvement is visible. Among those gathered, optimistic rumors are spreading. Some expect a miracle, while others hope for better results from a few methods of treatment. I do not try to brood over the future. I am concentrated on the present, leaving the possible sorrow in store for the time when the master will not be with me anymore. Of course, only in the physical sense. But I know that I am seeing him in the physical body for the last time. So, chapter 18, visiting caves. I used part of the time when Maharshi was absent from the temple hall to visit holy places in the vicinity. My first was to the sacred hill Arunachala, which rises high above the ashram, as if pointing to heaven with its sharp peak. I went to all the caves where the sage dwelt in his youth. One of the most famous is the Virupaksha cave, where the young Swami Ramana spent many years in meditation and ascetic discipline. It is said that in ancient times a great yogi was buried there. Well, that's not. You know the story about the Virupaksha cave, right?
Yes.
Now, I thought it strange, you know, I think we discussed that about his ashes, that St. Virupaksha's ashes were inside, you know, they locked him in a cave or something and they opened it up and all, they just found ashes there, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then when Bhagavan came, he mortared over those ashes or something, right?
I don't remember that, actually.
That the ashes were still, I thought, how could the ashes be there for a couple hundred years?
Yeah, it's more like, 300 years or something, right?
Yeah, so I always wondered, that sounds strange. But someone said, well, perhaps they were preserving them because they were charging people to come and see, and it was a source of income. I don't know. You know, they used to charge people to come see the ashes. Seems strange that after all these hundreds of years that someone didn't take away the ashes because they always consider these things holy or something. But Bhagavan was supposed to have mortared over those ashes, that's the mound you see on top of that platform.
Hmm. Yeah.
But he wasn't buried, just as he sort of went up in flames or something.
Right.
I easily found a little path on the slope. I easily found a little path on the slope of Arunachal leading to this cave. There I saw a big rock jutting out, and below it a small veranda with a concrete floor. An iron lattice all around, and small doors in the background. These were shut by a rusted and old, but still used lock. There were no signs of life. I went round the cave, plucked a few of the red flowers, and then sat quietly on a big warm stone. As I was deciding to return home, a thin, middle-aged Hindu came down from the hill and approached the cave. He saluted me in the usual Hindu manner, to which I responded by the same salute. Placing my palms together at the level of my chest, he opened the little iron gate and entered, inviting me with a kind gesture and smile to follow him. I had to bend almost double to pass through the very low and narrow doors. Inside, in the center of the little 9 by 9 foot cell, hollowed out of the rock, stood a small cubic altar about 5 feet high, covered with garlands and wild yellow flowers. In the center, blue blossoms were scattered, and a light was burning. On a shelf cut out of the rock stood an earthen water pot. By it, my new friend, the sannyasin, placed the small vessel containing food which he had just brought. Nothing else was to be seen in the cave. I sat down on the cleanly swept concrete floor near the stone altar. My host did the same. We understood each other without the need of words. He knew the purpose of my visit, and I understood well what this secluded silent hermitage meant for him. You know, the tree that Bhagavan planted, in which you see him and his mother sitting in front of, that old picture. They cut that down. And I saw it was cut this time. Last time I was there 2 years ago, it looked like it was almost dead. Now it's cut down. And then over the whole courtyard, they have like a thatched flat roof. It's quite fixed up quite a bit now.
Oh, did they do that very recently?
Well, I was there this year, you know, when I was there. I didn't notice it last time I was there, but... Yeah.
Okay.
They did a lot of work around, you know, around the outside area.
Oh. Okay.
Okay. In the afternoon, I went to another cave, situated somewhat higher up the hill, named Skanda Ashram. This was the next place where Maharshi stayed before he came down to the present ashram, where the grave of his mother, the temple, and all the buildings are now situated. As in Virupaksha, the rock platform is surrounded by a lattice wall, and from a palm grove and small garden, a few steps cut into the rock lead to a large veranda and several rooms inside. It was a Hindu holy day, and several festively dressed women and boys were standing on the veranda under the pleasant shade of the palms. A young Indian, with an intelligent and kind expression, came out to meet me. He showed me a small door leading inside. This cave was similar to, but looked a bit richer than the former one. An identical little altar stood in the center, adorned with flowers. The light was burning, and an old photograph of Maharshi in a meditation posture, probably taken some 40 years ago, was standing on the altar. Some mats with colored stripes were stretched on the floor. A young ascetic stood with folded hands and bowed before Maharshi's picture. I inquired whether this was a room where the sage had dwelt many years ago, as there were other little cells in the rock hermitage. He nodded assent. then went out for a moment, returning with a tray full of fresh ashes and a tiny vessel with a red powder called kumkum. Both are always used during puja, Hindu ritual worship. One had to make a small mark between the eyebrows with the red powder, and then three stripes on the forehead with the holy ashes. The first was easy, but the second I hesitated, not being sure how many stripes I must make, nor how to do it without risk of a mistake. The Swami, who was holding the tray, understood my uncertainty and immediately demonstrated with a kind gesture. Three stripes were to be done with three fingers. I followed his example, and after having complied with the ancient Aryan ritual, it's called an Aryan ritual, sat down quietly in the corner of the veranda near the Maharshi's former cell, and withdrew my consciousness from all objects, removing everything from its field. First, the colored saris of the women sitting opposite disappeared. Then the whisper of an old white bearded ascetic repeated his mantras just near me. When I returned to the visible world, I heard from afar the ashram gong calling for supper. Now, can you imagine hearing the gong up there now?
No.
And I'm sure they're using the same piece of railway iron and beating it the same way they've done for the last 80 years.
Right.
But there was no trees, of course. There was no other traffic on the road or anything like that.
Yeah, I think it's maybe more to do with the trees, right? That it's not heard now?
But yeah, more than the trees. But there's no buildings, so, well, I guess the trees. The buildings even, you know, there's a new dining hall behind there. And
right.
The trees are all grown up, planted in the ashram also.
Right.
When I returned, several miles, sound clearly heard for a radius of several miles. Here in the evening air, sounds are clearly heard for a radius of several miles. I silently took leave of the inmates of Skandashram and walked down the stony steps. So this evening, for the first time, I sat at the ashram meal with the signs on me of a Hindu sadhu, indicating a person dedicated to spiritual life. Maharshi's place was empty. Now these days, if he heard the gong and ran down there, he wouldn't be on time. They had shut the door.
I was just going to say, it'll take 20 minutes.
Yeah, but they didn't have that many people probably attending the lunch back then, and he was one of the few Westerners.
So they let him in.
Opposite me sat the newly arrived family of a Maharaja, his wife and two youngsters, his son and daughter. On the left was Yogi Ramaya's place, and on the right the senior pupils and inmates of the ashram. It seemed to me that the Maharaja's family were casting somewhat envious glances at my spoon, which was so comfortable to use, especially when dealing with liquids. For out of courtesy, they had to follow the common custom of eating with the hand, whereas when at home, they had probably long ago forsaken it. Chapter 19, Arunachala by day. Arunachala means the hill of light. According to an ancient custom, on the day of Shiva's festival called Kartikeya, a big fire fed with ghee, melted butter, is lit on the very top of Arunachala by the priest of the great Tiruvannamalai temple, about a mile from the ashram. The light is seen for miles all around as a hill stands solitary on the plains. The festival is celebrated every year in November. The legend says that many thousands of years ago, Shiva himself appeared on the hilltop as a column of fire. And since that time, the Kartikeya festival has always been celebrated. That is the visible side of it. But the esoteric significance is far richer and deeper. Maharshi called Arunachala the reflection of the divine absolute, bestowing liberation on those who strive sincerely for it. He also said it represents our true self. The essential reality, the spirit, the ultimate goal of our existence, or the Atman. The sage said clearly that though from the material point of view, Arunachala is only a senseless hill, a mass of rocks and stones, understood in its real aspect, it is the symbol of the highest being. I cannot here detail all the mythology connected with the holy hill. I shall merely quote in the a free translation of some significant words of the master. Quote, I discovered that the very thought about Arunachala, its mental picture, stops the movement of the thinking principle and gives the peace of achievement to the one who turns towards it. And there exists in this world a marvelous potion for those who have understood the ephemeral nature of worldly things and want to discard this form of life. This rare potion does not kill the physical man, but destroys his false separate personality, if he can only turn his thoughts towards it, know that it is none other than this holy Arunachala hill. One who constantly asks himself, who am I? What is the source of me? One who plunges into the depths of his being and finds the roots of the mind in the heart, he himself becomes the Lord of the universe, O Arunachala, ocean of bliss. I want also to give the literal version. I have discovered a new thing. This hill, the lodestone of life, arrests the movements of anyone who so much as thinks of it, draws him face to face with it, and fixes him motionless like itself to feed upon his soul thus ripened. What a wonder is this! O soul, beware of it and live. Such a destroyer of lives is this magnificent Arunachala, which shines within the heart. How many are there who have been ruined like me for thinking this hill to be the supreme? O men who, disgusted with the life of intense misery, seek a means of giving up the body, there is on earth a rare drug which, without actually killing him, will annihilate anyone who so much as thinks of it. Know that it is none other than this Arunachala. From the 11 verses to Arunachala. These mystical words of the sage have a deep meaning and also give some practical hints, but only for those who are consciously aiming at liberation. For these, the veil of words is lifted. And only then can they see the mystic light of Arunachala shining forth in their hearts. I begin to understand the meaning of the words. All the movements of the mind are stopped by Arunachala. It is difficult to convey, save to him who has experienced it. But it is a fact that even the picture of the strange shape of the hill of light, seen by our mind's eye, or the very remembrance of Arunachala, when one is afar from it, helps in a concentration which is not only the beginning, but a very condition of our advancement towards the goal. Today, taking advantage of Maharshi's absence from the hall, I've decided to explore the physical aspect of the hill. It means a climb to its summit. The weather is propitious, as the sky is cloudy and there is not the usual heat. A strong and rather fresh wind also helps my enterprise, which is not at all easy, for I do not know the way, and the slopes are steep and wild. It is difficult to see the path. In addition, the appearance of things from a distance is different from what it is when one actually reaches them. Places which, from the plain, seem quite easy to climb, prove on approach impossible to scale. This was the greatest difficulty of my adventure. Looking at the hill from below and following more or less a straight line, I traced my way through the slopes above the town of Tirunelveli and the ashram. On the whole, I climbed almost all the time, and generally at an angle of 45 degrees. I had to jump from one stone to another, avoiding the high, dense weeds which grew profusely between the rocks, as within them might be hidden snakes or scorpions so common in these parts. Soon the town, the great temple with its towers, and the buildings of the ashram became toys, and the herds of goats that were looking up at me from a lower slope seemed like ants. I noticed that the descent might be more difficult, for the stones, polished by rain and wind during the centuries, are round in shape and loosely embedded in the ground. Often they become dislodged and roll down the sides of the hill. After a half an hour climb, I reach a rock, which seen from below appeared to be about halfway. But now looking up at the peak, I saw that the distance yet to climb was more than double that which had been left behind. Moreover, the rock was so steep that there was no possibility of clambering over it with the aid of only the light bamboo stick I was carrying. The rock was lying directly across my chosen track, barring the way, and it seemed impossible to go around it. I saw that the seemingly easy valleys leading to the rocky peak were neither near nor easy to climb. At last I understood that I was not on the proper path. I remember the words of the chemist in Tiruvannamalai. They call compounder, right?
Yes.
Who said that the best way is opposite Shiva's temple, somewhat to the north. But it was too late now to find it. The only thing left, if I wanted to proceed and not to abandon my day's adventure, was to follow an almost invisible little track through the bushes and herbs on the left of the rock. It might prove to be longer, but there was no choice. I ceased looking where to step, as I had been doing before, because it took too much time. I thought of a cobra. I thought, if a cobra has to bite me, no care of mine can possibly prevent it. I simply fixed my attention on Arunachala, and after 1 hour reached the summit. Sitting on a stone near the place where the famous fire is lit, it was easy to recognize it by the black, fatty patch made by the burned ghee. I remembered Maharshi's advice as to how we should look at the material side of life, not allowing it to interfere with our constant search for light. Raise your head high. Do not look down on the tossy, stormy sea of transient life, else it will engulf you in its muddy waves. Fix your gaze aloft until you see the splendid reality. He's saying this is from the Maharshi sayings.
Doesn't say which one?
No, I don't know. I haven't heard, raise your head high. Do not look down on the tossy, stormy sea of life, else it will engulf you in its muddy waves. I haven't heard that one before.
Yeah, me neither.
It's a translation of something. The literal, here's another again, from Maharshi saying. The literal translation is, aim high, aim at the highest, and all lower aims are thereby achieved. It is looking below on the stormy sea of differences that makes you sink. Look up beyond these and see the one glorious real, and you are saved. I meditated upon the fact that humanity is seeking happiness and light. New teachings and new teachers. And yet so many marvelous truths are at its disposal in all the religions of the world and in the sayings of the mystics and masters that even one lifetime would not be enough to know them all. And in reality, one single maxim, if put into practice, suffices to guide us to the right path. Okay, right there, next chapter. The eye current. You're going to miss that.
Yeah.